The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Allergic skin disorders and hereditary angioedema is presented by Dr. Brian Martin.
So, we talked briefly about urticaria angioedema. I'm going to hustle through this because I can't imagine how tired you all must be. We know that urticaria is pruritic, erythematous, cutaneous elevations that blanch with pressure. And angioedema is deeper. So, angioedema is in the deep dermis or subcutaneous tissue. Swelling is its predominant manifestation. It typically does not itch. If anything, it hurts or burns. Angioedema is not characteristically in dependent areas. We see it with an asymmetrical distribution, and it's often seen with urticaria. The one thing that we need to understand when we talk about urticaria is the difference between acute urticaria and chronic urticaria. So we scientifically said, oh yeah, 6 weeks. That'll do it. So we arbitrarily designated 6 weeks to be the difference between acute urticaria and chronic urticaria. And when we look at urticaria, one of the things we need to look for, and sometimes appears on exams, is dermographism. And dermographism is simply the ability to write on the skin, and we'll look at that in a little bit. But one of the reasons that I think that it's important is we now have guidelines for urticaria. We have American guidelines and we have European World Allergy guidelines. This is out of an article that compares the American guidelines to the European / World Allergy Organization guidelines. And so where they disagree, those probably aren't places where we're going to have test questions because there's controversy. Where they agree is a good test question. And where they agree is for chronic spontaneous urticaria, the first-line treatment is second-generation antihistamines. Now, I've just spent all this time making fun of antihistamines for anaphylaxis. For urticaria, first-line treatment, second-generation antihistamines. The second-line treatment is to increase the second-generation antihistamines. In the European guidelines, they say take them up to 2 to 4 times normal dose. In the American guidelines, they say take them up to 2 to 4 times the recommended dose, or use a different second-generation antihistamine or add an H2 antagonist. There are several more ORs there. Those ORs are probably not going to be tested. For third line, there's a mild disagreement between the American and the European guidelines. The European said, after you've taken your second-generation antihistamine to 4 times normal dose, add omalizumab. The Americans say, you can now add first-generation antihistamines as the third level, and we'll find omalizumab in the American fourth level. The Europeans have already given omalizumab on the third level, and they'll go to cyclosporine on the fourth level. So the agreement is we start treatment for chronic spontaneous urticaria with second-generation antihistamines. We take them up to 4 times recommended dose. At that point, the most likely alternative would be to go to omalizumab. If that doesn't work, cyclosporine. What is not present in the guidelines is corticosteroids at all. Why? Corticosteroids are certainly going to make, oral prednisone is going to make that urticaria go away until you stop giving the oral steroids. And then it's going to come back with a passion. You'll actually have a rebound effect from it. So corticosteroids are not in the urticaria guidelines. So our first patient's a 42-year-old with a chief complaint of whelps for 2 months. So it passes our 6 weeks of therapy. has a lot of itching, can't describe any lifestyle changes, has been to a bunch of doctors, they didn't help, they gave him a bunch of drugs, took a bunch of lab, nothing helped. You do a physical examination, this is what the patient looks like, you press on those lesions, they blanch. He's got papules and plaques. No individual lesion lasts more than 24 hours. So when we do our urticaria examination, we really don't expect to find a trigger. If you don't find a trigger very quickly, and in fact, if the patient doesn't come in essentially saying, I think it's X, you're probably not going to find the trigger. But you do want to make sure you're dealing with urticaria, and this is where good test questions could come from. You want to know the lesional history. How long has each lesion been there? Is it painful or is it itchy? Because what you want to know is, could this possibly be something other than simple chronic spontaneous urticaria? Could this be a vasculitis or could this be an underlying systemic disease? So you need to take a history or look for a history in the test question of that would lead you toward a systemic disease. We also have physical urticarias. I talked about dermographism. These are two pictures of dermographic people. The guy on the top, you can see, scratched his chest and his abdomen, and everywhere he scratched, he is now left behind these welts. And then on the bottom with the tic-tac-toe crosses is just to show that how the skin reacts when it's irritated. We can have cold urticaria. We can have urticaria to water. Cold urticaria is a great test question because it has a great picture. And my favorite is this one on top because you see not only the square where an ice cube was placed. An ice cube test is just that. You put an ice cube on the patient's skin. But I love the little tail where the water ran off. And they also have a reaction where the cold water was. So again, you might see something like this. Dermographism has been a test question on a number of board examinations. When they throw you a low softball, don't miss it. Make sure you grab it. So skin tests are typically of little value for urticaria. Most urticaria is not triggered by food or by aeroallergens. There are no routine labs for urticaria. The labs that we order are driven by our history and our physical examination, not routine. They may include a TSH, CBC, liver function test, sed rate, ANA, C4 if you suspect that there's a complement problem here. And skin biopsy may be indicated as indicated again by history. But when we look at urticaria, we can't miss other skin diseases. And that's where they're going to try to aim you. So make sure that you're looking out for other possibilities. Urticarial vasculitis, does the patient have a virus? Is it contact dermatitis? Is it underlying parasitic disease or underlying liver disease? Is it lupus? Is there a malignancy? And another favorite, beautiful image, is something like this. And these patches will allow what's called Derrière's sign. Derrière was a French dermatologist who found that you have, these are actually areas where there's a concentration of mast cells. And so if you stroke your finger across it, you'll get a fairly good wheal and flare reaction, much like dermographism, but it's just localized to where these little brown macules are. So two points there. One is localized collection of mast cells. Two is Derrière sign. And if we see that in adults, we have to worry about them progressing to systemic mast cell disease, like mastocytosis, which can come, it can present from an indolent format the whole way through an aggressive mast cell leukemia and can involve the number of organs. Urticarial vasculitis, we can't miss. This can be a necrotizing vasculitis. The key points are if a lesion lasts more than 24 hours or if a lesion leaves behind something when it disappears. So if there's bruising, if there's skin discoloration when the lesion appears, it's something other than urticaria. So we'll leave urticaria behind. We'll go to angioedema. You've already seen one image of angioedema. Angioedema can affect as much as 20% of the population. The vast majority of cases are drug-induced with ACE inhibitors or NSAIDs. So this is non-pitting edema. It's deeper than urticaria. The overlying skin is typically normal. It burns. It doesn't itch. If we look specifically at ACE-induced angioedema, one of the important factoids for the test and for lifetime is about 70% of the patients who are going to have ACE-induced angioedema will have it in the first week of therapy. What that means is 30% can have their first episode of angioedema months after they started therapy. So it doesn't have to happen right when the therapy is begun. You can have life-threatening upper airway obstruction with ACE-induced angioedema. But an area that I think is going to be important on this exam, or has potential to be important because of new treatments, is hereditary angioedema. So this is another area that I think we should spend a little time and a little concentration on. Hereditary angioedema is typically autosomal dominant. Its onset is typically in adolescence, but it can take quite a long time to be diagnosed. This is a problem that people have, and they get misdiagnosed and passed around for some amount of time. So you can see it in an older adult. This is painless, non-pruritic angioedema. It lasts 3 to 5 days, doesn't respond to epinephrine, doesn't respond to antihistamine, doesn't respond to prednisone, and it's typically triggered by relatively mild trauma. Of course, you know, what's the good of having a problem if you can't have more than one type of your problem? So we have a type 1 hereditary angioedema, which is a deficiency of C1 esterase inhibitor. You don't have enough. So you get a quantitative deficiency, you look for it, and you have 5 to 30% of normal. In type 2, you have plenty, but it doesn't work. So if you just do a test to look at quantitative C1 esterase inhibitor, it's normal. If you do functional C1 esterase inhibitor, that is abnormal. It's markedly reduced. Type 3, like we talked about in LAD, is not going to be on the test and creates a lot of arguing. In hereditary angioedema, the screening test is C4. Screening test is C4. So C4 and C2 are both going to be low all the time, both during attacks and in between attacks. The symptoms are related to this submucosal subcutaneous edema. C1 is normal. So if we see a low C1, that's an acquired form of angioedema. And that can be seen particularly in underlying lymphomas. So if we have acquired angioedema rather than hereditary angioedema, it's a rare condition. It's present in adults, typically seen in patients who have underlying systemic disease or cancer. It has decreased C4, just like hereditary angioedema. It's the decreased C1q which distinguishes hereditary angioedema from acquired. And if you look at this chart, so here we have hereditary angioedema type 1 and 2, acquired angioedema type 1 and 2. The only thing that's going to differentiate hereditary angioedema and acquired angioedema is low C1q. So here's why I think this is important, though. These are the new treatments that have come out for HAE. And when you have 7 new treatments for a disease, it's been relatively popular, and we have to figure out a way to think through them. We have 3 prophylactic treatments. 1 is IV, 2 are subcutaneous, 2 are C1 esterase inhibitors, and the 3rd is a monoclonal antibody. So I always look at what's different. So when we have something that is a plasma kallikrein inhibitor that's a monoclonal antibody, that might make a good test question. If we look at the 4 acute treatments, what I find fascinating is 2 are IV, 2 are subcutaneous. Both of the IV products are approved for self-administration in adequately trained patients. But one of the subcutaneous products is not approved for patient self-administration. So it has the Kalbitor has to be given by a healthcare professional. It can't be given at home by the patient. And so when I would look at a list of drugs like this, I would say, which ones of these are different and why? If you look at atopic dermatitis, I'm going to try to run through this, but atopic dermatitis is yet another disease in the allergy lexicon that has had a lot of press lately. So it's a characteristic cutaneous inflammatory condition, typically occurs in patients with a history of atopy or a family history of atopy. This is part of the atopic march. So this happens in atopic patients. It's a chronic relapsing inflammatory skin manifestation of the atopic triad. And in all of the industrial nations, we're seeing an increase in atopic dermatitis. There's typically no primary lesion. We have this intensely pruritic condition with erythematous papules and excoriations and vesiculations that can lead to a serous exudate and can lead to lichenification. So if you continue to attack your skin because it itches, the skin is going to defend itself. And it's going to defend itself by lichenifying, by making itself thicker and tougher so that it can stand up to your crazy scratching. So we do have a 2018 atopic dermatitis yardstick. So this is the closest we have to a guidelines. And what I think is so important, if you look at this, it says this is non-lesional skin, then mild, moderate, and severe. And even non-lesional skin is not normal skin. It's non-lesional skin. So we have to, the most important thing for atopic dermatitis is to make sure that we keep the skin moisturized and that we keep the non-lesional skin moisturized. And we'll talk a little bit about what to do when that doesn't work. So patients who have atopic dermatitis have a history of atopy, they itch like crazy, and they have this eczematous reaction of the skin. It's typically, when you talk about the genetics, we just don't understand enough of it. No test question there. A real live question that I get all the time is, if I have atopic dermatitis, are my children condemned to atopic dermatitis? And the statistics are that if both parents have atopic dermatitis, it's an 81% chance that the child will. If one parent has atopic dermatitis and the other has allergies, not atopic dermatitis, but some other allergies, aeroallergen allergies, it drops to 60% risk. And if only one patient has atopic dermatitis and the other parent is not atopic, it's still a 56% risk. So pretty high risk that your kids are going to have problems. So our patients who have atopic dermatitis have atopy. They have pruritus as a primary problem, and they have allokinesis. And allokinesis is important. So allokinesis is, once your skin starts to itch, it wants friends. And it wants friends who itch. So when you have an area of your skin that itches, the likelihood that the surrounding skin will begin to itch in concert increases. And antihistamine doesn't do a lot for atopic dermatitis itching. Well, we have to look for triggers. Wool, soaps, disinfectants, dryness, all can trigger atopic dermatitis, as can heat, sweating, contactants. So there are a number of things that don't cause atopic dermatitis, but trigger it once it's present. We also have to pay attention to microbial agents on the skin, and particularly Staph aureus, and in some patients, viruses. So the eczema part of atopic dermatitis is the response to trauma. We scratch, and if you look at where people have atopic dermatitis skin lesions, it's always where they can reach. It's not the middle of the back. It's not places you can't reach. And so we excoriate the skin, and what happens is we can then allow that infection to begin in the areas that we've dug into and have excoriated. We have to differentiate it from all of these things: allergic contact dermatitis, irritant contact dermatitis, important things like scabies. So there's a relatively long list for a differential diagnosis. And this can be quite severe. Here we see the excoriated skin in the places where we've dug into the skin. And you can see if you were Staph aureus, that would be just a great place to set up a house for housekeeping. And then this is why. So on our non-lesional skin, remember, it's not normal skin. It's simply uninvolved right now. When something causes the skin to itch, wool, heat, dryness, whatever triggers the itching, then we begin to draw our atopic elements into the skin. We begin to see inflammation of the skin, and this is where what we call the itch, scratch, itch cycle occurs. And as we continue to excoriate the skin, it's trying to protect itself, and we're beginning to get more and more inflammatory agents into the area. As we then make those little pock marks, we get microbial infection in the skin, which causes the skin to react even more. So when we look at atopic dermatitis, the first thing we have to do is take a good history and physical examination. Again, there is no routine lab work for atopic dermatitis. We run just essentially on the basis of the history and physical that we do to determine what parts of these things we might need to do, to include the potential for prick skin testing. Complications, the primary complication is secondary infection, and that we have to really be careful about allowing patients to have secondary infection on their atopic dermatitis, because it can look like this. Fungal infections of the feet can look like this. It's somebody with atopic dermatitis with a superimposed fungal infection on the feet. And sometimes it can be relatively subtle, but while that doesn't look bad, it itches like crazy and diminishes a patient's quality of life. Most people who have atopic dermatitis began to have problems with atopic dermatitis as a child. The earlier the onset, the more likely we're going to have a severe course. And so we typically have improvement by puberty, and it's rare to see atopic dermatitis. I see it, but I'll still say what the books say, which is it's rare to see atopic dermatitis after 50. We want to carefully eliminate all the triggers. Remember, triggers didn't cause the atopic dermatitis, but they will make it worse, and to do everything that we can to get the patient to quit scratching on the skin, to make sure that the skin is lubricated and not irritated. Now, topical anti-inflammatory agents are the primary role, and that would be either corticosteroids or tacrolimus. If we have a systemic problem, it's interesting because antibiotics can help with skin. It can help with the infections on the skin. And sometimes we'll have to use prednisone or cyclosporine. But atopic dermatitis has profound effects on those who are involved. And atopic dermatitis is a issue that we're taking more and more seriously as we understand how much their lifestyle is affected. So we're going to go to the patient here, a 21-year-old with an itchy rash. It's worse in summer and winter. He's worried about food allergies. That's why he came. He's had this rash for a while. And so what do you think this is, and what are you going to do about it? Are you going to treat him with topical antibiotics, with topical steroids, oral steroids, dapsone, or famciclovir? This is actually a pretty easy atopic dermatitis. It's not very bad. It's on the flexor surfaces of his arm. So we would initially treat this patient with topical steroids. Here's a little bit worse, a little bit more excoriated. We often see it on the hands, so this is actually a fairly typical presentation that you'll see. This is also a presentation, but there's something that in terms of testing that I want you to look at. Look at this patient's, not just his skin and as bad as that is, but look at his eyes and look at the difference in how irritated this eye in particular is, because when we see facial atopic dermatitis and we see it around the eyes, we have to put atopic keratoconjunctivitis into our differential diagnosis. And we have to remember that the treatment of the eye is very different than the treatment of skin, and it can be also involved. When we use our topical corticosteroids, potency becomes very important. So we don't use high potency steroid creams on the face, on the breasts, or on the genitals, because it has these skin side effects of atrophy, telangiectasia, striae. And so what we want to do potentially is either use low potency steroids on those areas or use topical immune modulators like tacrolimus or pimecrolimus creams. So these are derived from fungal polypeptides. When they first came out, people were afraid of them. People were afraid they could potentially cause cancer, and they burn when you put them on. But what we found is these are really helpful drugs. They're potent immunostimulators. They work slowly, but they can help us get away from putting corticosteroids on somebody's face. So they're effective for children and for adults both. You don't have the steroid side effects when you lose these immune modulators. You do have stinging, and patients will complain that it stings. And there's a concern, and I've never seen this, but there's a concern about an increase in skin infections when you use an immune modulator on the skin. And then finally, we have this 20-year-old male with this isolated itchy rash. What is it? Contact dermatitis to nickel. So how are we going to, what are we going to test? How are we going to test him? We want to do patch testing, delayed hypersensitivity intradermal skin testing, IgE-mediated skin test, or no testing will show us anything. We need patch testing on this particular case. This is a type 4 mediated reaction, allergic contact dermatitis. The treatment will be avoidance. We can give him topical steroids, or if it's bad enough, a couple of weeks of oral steroids. So here's an easy diagnosis up top. This is a type 4 reaction. What is it? Poison ivy, linear vesicular lesions. This is to chromate in the leather, in the watch band, and you can see that's pretty easy. This is the one that's always fun. They give you a picture of somebody with contact dermatitis around the eyes. What's the primary reason? Is it eye makeup? No, it's fingernail polish. We have so much time with our fingers in our eyes that the number one cause of the rash around the eyes is going to be fingernail polish. This is what patch testing looks like. This is what a positive patch test looks like.